Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. Today I have a very special guest with me. Is Mr. Frank Martin of the Medical Consultants Group. And, you know, each week we talk about how we can navigate this labyrinth of healthcare. And it seems to be getting harder. We talk about it a lot, about how hard it is for private practice doctors, independent doctors, to remain open and to practice medicine in the way they were trained to do. It's changed, of course, but for those of us who trained using the Hippocratic Oath and where it was patient-centered, we still want to stay open and we still want to provide services and care to our patients, and it's becoming harder. There are more regulations coming down the pipe every day. I subscribe to a Medicare email, and there are thousands of emails coming through with new regulations. You can't keep it straight, and it seems that you're guilty until proven innocent, and if you run afoul of any regulation, there's no wiggle room. They assume that you did it on purpose, and they will start coming after us as physicians. And Mr. Martin has a company that is designed to improve our efficiency, to help us navigate the system, and to really be able to play this game. And there's lots of ways to play it. You can opt out of the system. You can take fee-for-service only, direct pay. You can join together and form a consortium of doctors. And, you know, Mr. Martin, I want to definitely talk about all the services that you offer, because it's not one thing. It's about EHRs. It's about how to contract. It's about everything that doctors need to know to be business people. We weren't built to be business people. We're just built to take care of our patients. And what we've done is just work harder and not smarter. And we're just, morale is gone. It's just devastated. And I want to thank you very much for spending the time to come on my show today.
It's a pleasure for me to be here. And thank you very much for the introduction. You're right. My job at the end of the day is to help the practice become a better business. And that goes all the way from patient acquisition to operations, to patient retention, to making sure that you get maximum pay for performance bonuses. But like in any business, technology, people and processes have to align themselves with each other in order for the business to achieve optimal success. And that's really what the whole system is all about. Most practices don't think of themselves as a business, and they don't organize around market share.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they haven't defined their market in terms of zip codes. They haven't decided on a particular kind of demographic. They don't understand how to differentiate themselves from other competitors. I mean, they think that if I just get on the website and say that I'm a great doctor and a good person, there's not many doctors are going to get on the website and say, I'm a bad doctor and a bad person. So those aren't differentiators.
True.
So you have to understand that. And you measure your success, not necessarily by how I'm doing this year versus last year. You can measure your success by what share of my market do I have? And you can begin to organize around that. A lot of times doctors' offices don't set themselves up as meritocracies. They set themselves up, but they give bonuses at the end of the year, and they don't give them for performance. They give them for political acumen. Okay? Now, first of all, if you're going to give a Christmas bonus, that's great. But if you have a bad year and don't give the Christmas bonus, now you're a Grinch. So kind of the only thing you can do is lose there.
Mm-hmm.
If the bonus is not based on criteria, performance criteria that everyone in the practice can understand, it's a political game, and now you're paying people to become political. And I don't think that helps performance.
How do you break that cycle? Because that's how most business people think that's how you do it. You just do it across the board. How do you set up a system that breaks that cycle?
The first thing you have to do is have a strategic plan for the practice. Inside that strategic plan, that starts at the top for the entire practice. You break that down into what a lot of people refer to as interlocking and cascading goals for each position. You build position objectives with specific metrics, performance metrics, and you reward against those metrics. There's a difference, again, there's a big difference between a performance evaluation and a salary evaluation. You can do a salary review yearly.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a performance evaluation quarterly. You can do it every month if you want to. The deal is to have the employee and the manager sit down and review the employee's performance versus the metrics of the position. And that way the employee understands. And if the employee has done received a bad performance review for three quarters in a row, and then their salary review comes up, they shouldn't really be surprised if they don't get a big increase.
That's a good point. That's takes all of the guesswork out, takes the emotion out, and it's about get your job done. And you have, you know, the employee, I'm sure, has the internal push to do it because they know, you know, they're getting a reward for what they do, not just because you like them, which is actually kind of neat. I'm going to try that myself. So let's talk about the demographic and the patient. And the patient is the customer. I think that's what you'd mentioned. What do you have to do to this is a big market, as I'm sure any big city is. How do you carve out your niche? I mean, you can be I'm a great doctor. My colleagues are great doctors. And I felt that my company, Peachtree ENT Center, I've been open since 2001, was the best kept secret because we practiced medicine. I never changed. It was 45 minutes at first visit. It was answer your own phone calls, take your own call, and be available and accessible to the patient. And nobody does that anymore. And so it was my mission to actually get us out there and get known. It's happening, but I probably could have done this years ago in a much more efficient manner. And it was like one of those things where you throw it up on a wall, see if it sticks, and it's now sticking. But what do doctors need to do to avoid the just trial and error?
If you look at businesses, there's really not very many basic value propositions with which you can go to market. Mercedes-Benz goes to market with a much different value proposition than Hyundai. Everybody's familiar with car analogies. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mercedes-Benz is clearly product expertise and product technology superiority. Hyundai is pretty much it's a reasonable with a great warranty. Now, if you went into a Mercedes dealership and you asked them, do you have a 10-year warranty? They'd look at you funny. I mean, that's not why you'd really buy a Mercedes. Right, you're into image. You're not necessarily just like if you go into a Honda dealership and say, "How fast will this thing go from 0 to 100?" Yeah, they don't want that question. If you want to talk about reliability, they're all about that. Right, so a doctor can brand themselves as being a subject matter expert, like you, a specialist. But again, that breaks down. You can be a subject matter expert with access. You can be a subject matter expert who has set up their office to accommodate patients and optimize the patient experience while the patient's in the office. There are things in the world of customer satisfaction that are referred to as shadow events. It's an event that casts a shadow on the rest of the experience. The example that everyone's able to relate to is airlines. Okay, if the plane leaves on time, the seat's more comfortable, the meal's better, the movie is more enjoyable. If the plane leaves 45 minutes late, the seat's not right, the meal's not good.
Yeah.
There are a couple of shadow events in a doctor's office. How much time does the patient spend in the waiting room? That's one. How much time does the patient spend unattended in the exam room? Everybody's time is valuable. Okay. So you want to make sure that the patient spends the minimum amount of time in the waiting room, the minimum amount of time unattended in the exam room. And then when the patient is with a member of the staff, the member of the staff certainly treats them cordially. And that's, I think, patient has a connotation that the patient needs the practice more than the practice needs the patient. But if you think about them as a customer, now all of a sudden that's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a believer in kind of changing that terminology because I think it helps change the dynamics of the relationship.
Yeah, I think customer service is integral to an excellent doctor-patient relationship. I mean, you can walk into a room and the patient is just like they're totally closed off and they're hostile. And your job is to change that. And you shouldn't have to open the door and you meet that. And if they've had a bad experience before they get to see you, you spend a lot of time, you know, dismantling the armory. It also goes back and forth to the patient. And I think patients have responsibilities as well. And when you walk into a doctor's office, you should know why you're there. You should know what medications you're on. I mean, little simple things like that, which is not allowed to ask. And you can walk into a patient's room and the opposite is, oh, I don't know why I'm here. And you're just supposed to tease all of this out in the time allotted. So it's a bilateral responsibility. We shouldn't, as physicians, have to bear it all. And patients shouldn't have to bear it all. We should be a partnership. And I think that's the collegial side of medicine that, to me, has disappeared. Patients think you should just write a prescription sometimes, walk in, or better yet, not even see them, just call it in. And if you don't, there's something wrong with you. And then there's all these extenders, ancillary staff that you go through this gauntlet before you see the doctor, and then you see them for 7 minutes. They don't look at you. Their back is turned, running on an EHR system. So that's also, you know, we've taken the personality out of it. And how do we stop it from being a conveyor belt driven system? The EHR, the electronic medical records, were touted to be the best thing since sliced bread. More efficiency, better billing, better patient satisfaction. I find that it depends on what model you have in your office, a hurdle to patient care. It takes longer to get through the visit. Pointing and clicking before you can close a section. You have to type in everything. Nothing's really user-friendly, or it's all templated and you can't personalize it. So how do you break the movement? And I think there is a movement towards more automation, less individual care. How do you bridge that so you can be efficient and still be like a family physician?
Before I started my own company, I was the president of an EMR company. And we spent a lot of time thinking about screen presentations that would increase the amount of time the doctor could be in what we called a heads-up mode, looking at the patient, instead of a heads-down mode, looking at the computer. Templatizing encounters and workflows is one way you can do that, but now you're kind of forcing the doctor into one-size-fits-all, okay? Which is not a good idea, because physicians are interesting because they're not a market. They're a whole series of micro markets. I remember at one point in time, we had two doctors who grew up in a small town in Alabama, went to the same college, went to the same medical school, and did their internships at the same place, mm-hmm. came back, went to set up practice. And Dr. A said, he wanted an EMR. Dr. B said, that's fine. I'll take the same one he's got because it'll be just the same. When he looked at Dr. A's workflows, he was like, well, that's all wrong. And we were just amazed, because if there were two people that had, you know, that much in common and shared experiences, we kind of thought their workflows would be similar. Mm-hmm. No, real different. So the EMR has to give the physician the ability to create a complete and accurate clinical picture of the patient in the shortest amount of time possible. Mm-hmm. Okay, but complete and accurate trumps time.
Absolutely. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Honestly, if we could just mic what goes on in the breaks, we would have a whole different show. We were speaking in more detail about efficiency. And I was telling Mr. Martin that for me, it's about, I need to write my history and physical out. Because that picture, if I pull that chart a month, a year from now, and I read my own handwriting and read my thoughts at the time, I can visualize the patient. And I can't do that if it's a point click and kind of a menu version of the HMP. And again, it's all about individual, how doctors handle their business and seeing their patients. You just gave a great example. No two doctors is the same. And that's the problem with the system that we're entering. They assume, one, that doctors are criminals, that all we want to do is cut off feet, take out tonsils, and make a buck, order a test for no reason to make our mortgage. That's what they assume about us, the worst. And we've let them. And this whole system is being built on no trust of us, taking away our individual right to treat our patients and our patients' individual right to be treated. And they're quantitating or monetizing exactly what it means to be a doctor. How do we use these systems in a way that's going to enhance our ability to be individuals while still being within the bounds of this system? That's a really tough question. It's kind of, I guess, loaded. But how can you do that? Or is it even possible?
Possible, yes. I think you're absolutely right. Do you remember when the federal government loaned money to banks that were in trouble? And a lot of banks, when they saw the stipulations that were attached to the loan, they said, you know what? Never mind. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of doctors saw meaningful use reimbursement as being a wonderful way to get some money.
It was 1%. What it would have ended up being, $100, a couple hundred bucks at the end of the year? Yeah, okay.
but when they signed up for that, they also signed up to make the federal government a partner in their practice. Because now you're kind of, the federal government dictates to you how you're going to use the EMR. ICD-10s are one step in that direction. ICD-10s are, again, used in most of the rest of the world. There's certainly some good news there. They give you a chance to express yourself in codes that are much more specific. Okay.
Too specific?
Well, that's the question. Okay. Mm-hmm. Some of the ICD-10 codes are a little strange. Hurt in an in a water skiing accident or burned by a turkey fryer, and then there's another one burned for the second time by a turkey fryer. I mean, so specificity sometimes can be a little overly done.
Yeah.
But it is an attempt on the plus side. It's an attempt for people to understand how to manage populations of patients. And of course, you can't help manage them if you don't understand what group they're in.
That is a problem. You just said a mouthful there. Manage populations of patients. What the? Are you kidding me? So that means everybody becomes part of a group. You're no longer an individual. Population-based medicine. As soon as you hit a certain age, you're going to a hospice. You're not getting the glasses. I mean, you're getting the glasses, not the cataract surgery. That's the next step. You're making this easier for people to be put in groups and manage as a disease state, an ethnic group, a race, a sex. Nobody works that way. We're all individuals. The whole thing, to me, is built to fail.
I agree. Now, you talked about how to beat the system.
Yes, okay. Definitely.
I believe in data. Okay? I believe the harder you try to put people into groups, the more individuals will stand out. I believe there would be more and more outliers. This is kind of a weird analogy, but on a scale of insect intelligence, bees are much smarter than flies. If you put a bunch of bees into a glass jar, open, take the cap off the jar, point the closed end toward the sun, the bees will dutifully and in a very organized fashion continue to fly into the closed end of the jar until they all perish. Flies, on the other hand, who are not nearly as smart as bees, they don't have the social organization, they don't have the specialization within the community, you do the same experiment to them and they will happily buzz around randomly until soon they've all escaped the jar. The point is you have to leave room for experimentation. If everybody always does the same thing, you're going to get the same results. And one of the things that we should take advantage of is the fact that there's so many doctors treating so many patients and there's so much creativity and so many good ideas that we're going to stumble across better ways to treat patients.
I wish that were the case. And I think in a free market system, that would be the case. But they are gaming the system. So they are systematically reducing and crushing any of that fly behavior. They are using meaningful use. They're using maintenance of certification. They are now starting to have licensure across multiple states. So that once you meet criterion one, you're already licensed in other states, which means they can turn it off when they want to as well. There's so many pressures to make you go along and get along. And I have to say that it's legislated in. So we have evidence-based medicine. That's what they're basing it on. It is not me finding out the best way to treat a sinus infection without using antibiotic, for example, or me using a natural approach for reflux that really works just as well as a prescription. That is not entered into this system. That is removed from this system with a hammer, right? So they're going to come down on you and saying that you are an outlier, which to me is a good thing, to them is a bad thing, and they'll get rid of you as a disruptive physician, as not part of your medical community. You're billing in a way that doesn't fit the norm. Even though you're spending double the time with the patient, that's the problem for me. They don't take the individual effort, the individual outcome of your practice into consideration. You're part of this herd. That if it really were the way you said, I would say I'd be all for it, because it would be moving towards better medicine, more efficient medicine, better outcomes at a reasonable price. It doesn't. It works towards taking, for example, admitting a patient to a hospital and doing a pre-screen or a pre-workup for MRSA, that's the resistant staph infection, even though the person doesn't have it, but they're getting blood cultures, they're getting put on vancomycin, they're getting this $1 million workup when they don't have the disease, or the diabetes protocol where you end up on a sliding scale insulin and all these other things, and you don't need it. That's where it's gone. It's gone to no thought, just follow an algorithm. And they never ask the people who are on the front line what the algorithm should be. If they'd asked us, we could tell them, make the shortcut. You don't need this protocol. It doesn't work. It's not efficient. They don't ask us. They pronounce it. How do we get them? Or, how do we, again, it's again a loaded question. How do we make that, knowing what they think about us and how, as doctors and patients, how do we still get through that system, keep our individuality, be advocates for our patients and not agents for the government, for example?
I was at a conference of orthopedic surgeons. The subject was bipolar hip replacements. Several different physicians opined from the podium. And then one physician came up and placed about 6 inches worth of documents on the podium and said, well, I understand and appreciate all of the opinions that have been expressed by my colleagues. I would like to share with you the data from all of my experiences. And thankfully, data won the day. Now, I think each individual physician has to be able to keep very good data and prove their case. Mm-hmm. Because, look, in businesses, management people will come in, okay? And top management, everybody has theories about how the world works. Top managers will, in lots of cases, try to impose their theories of the world and theories of business on the rest of the company without necessarily understanding the data at the individual customer level. That's why there's lots of turnover, mm-hmm. okay? And why you see lots of companies fail, and you have to stay in tune with the customer, and that has to be data driven. So I think that the doctor's defense against power is data. And I don't think there's any question, but that's the nature of the battle. I believe the bureaucrats are attempting to use power to force medicine to become another arm of the government. Okay? And I don't think that's a good idea. I think that each individual doctor can and should run their own practice. And I think the defense against the power move is the data available. So I think that each individual physician should be working assiduously to keep their data as clean, neat, and well organized as possible so they can defend themselves.
And I guess EMRs are a really easy way to do that, to quantitate it. You can run reports, you can do things with how many people come back with a recurrent sinus infection or whatever the thing is with your treatment regimen. That would be one way to do it, would it not?
Absolutely. And there are lots of EMRs that facilitate that. But again, you have to go into it kind of knowing your strategic plan as a physician. And that strategic plan has to cover what metrics will I gather? How will I define success? Very well known that outcomes are difficult to get to. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you can define inputs. You can define the amount of money spent. If you can't define an outcome, which I get, okay, but you can define the amount of money the patient spent and whether or not they came back.
I like that. I mean, from another standpoint, and this is really a real-time question for doctors who are in private practice, what is it that they need to do, that we as private practice physicians need to do to make ourselves more visible? Right now, the movement is towards bigger is better, bigger box, corporate-driven hospital systems. They are Pac-Manning most of the market. And I think patients are just, they really are ignorant of what their choices are. They think that if it's bigger, it's better. They don't realize that if you go into those systems, you're paying double, triple for less care most of the time than you would if you had gone to a private practice physician and actually maybe paid a little bit, maybe actually paid less, to tell you the truth, during the whole visit. How do we carve out that market so that people get to realize that the quality of medicine, or it's a two-tier system, in my opinion, already. You have the corporate-driven, big box, large group practice model, and the solo small group practice model, who are not associated, not on the staff, not on the payroll of a hospital. There are two different types of medicine that are coming online. How do we position ourselves that doctors, that patients know we exist, that they know that they have options in their healthcare insurance choices? What do we need to do? And I know we're going to take a break in a minute, so I'll let you think on that. But to me, that's the answer that needs to be asked, or the question needs to be asked, so that we can continue to have private doctors in our country, because otherwise, I think we'll be legislated and pushed out from a market perspective. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
The War State by Michael Swanson is a must-read for anyone interested in the critical 20 years after World War II, when the United States morphed from a constitutional republic to a global imperial superpower. Get The War State by Michael Swanson from Amazon.com today.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call. and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today we have Mr. Frank Martin on from the Medical Consultants Group, and we're talking, having a little bit different type of conversation about the mechanics and logistics of medicine. You know, I know from an emotional standpoint what it's going, where it's going, but we're going to try to figure out today how we keep it from getting to the point where we don't want it to get to, and we can still really work or enhance the good part of what healthcare is doing. And in the before the break, or in the break, we were talking about we should be optimistic. Tell us about that.
I really do believe there are grounds for optimism. I think one of the things that, hasn't changed and that won't change is people's desire to be understood and people's desire to be treated as an individual. And I think that small practices have an inherent advantage in meeting that need. If you go to a big box practice, you are by definition part, you're a number. Mm-hmm. I had to call my bank the other day. I won't mention the name of the bank, but the person I got on the other phone, on the other end of the phone, said, "This is your personal banker. Could you give me your name, please?" And I asked, I said, did the irony of that statement ever occur to you? And the person on the other phone said, "Yes, but that's what they tell me to say."
Wow.
Okay. I mean, I get that. Right. But the primary area of dissatisfaction, from what I can find out regarding doctors who have gone to work for big box systems, is the fact they become just part of the system and no longer have a voice on how to treat patients. And that makes, from the corporate perspective, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If I'm Ford Motor Company, I would prefer your brand loyalty to be with Ford, not with the local sales guy. Because the local sales guy could leave and sell a Toyota. So I want you bound more to the corporate than I do to the local person. Pretty much that's exactly the same way hospitals feel. Why wouldn't they? It's in their self-interest to do so.
Well, it's also this, if you can speak to this, we talk a lot about being non-profit, not-for-profit, but these not-for-profit hospitals are making hand-over-fist bucks. How does that work? I mean, from a business perspective, I thought you're not supposed to make a profit when you're a nonprofit. How do CEOs pull in this type of money? And you know, ultimately, it's all about keeping that bottom line fed and making the system more efficient so you can funnel the money upward, not to patient care. I've never seen a patient given a deal, you know, unless you ask for it. They're not going to volunteer you getting a deal in a hospital. You have to ask for it. It exists. But they want you to be ignorant to that fact. They want you to pay whatever it is, not ask questions and just do it. So I know it's a loaded question again, but this is why you're on the show, right? How can they get away with making this kind of profit and call themselves nonprofit? That's my first question.
I was listening to an interview with the CEO of a for-profit hospital and the CEO of a nonprofit hospital, and the interviewer was comparing prices. And amazingly enough, the for-profit hospital had about the same prices as the not-for-profit hospital. And so the interviewer asked the nonprofit CEO, "Well, I mean, I know where the money is going in the other system. Where's the money going for you? Are your costs different? And if they are, how does that reflect itself in patient care?" Okay, because I could understand if you were spending more to care for the patient. If it doesn't reflect itself in patient care and the differential is about the same from a cost versus sale price standpoint, where does that money go? The CEO clearly did not like the question, okay, and said it goes to a fund. Well, what fund? Mm-hmm. And what do you do with that fund? One of the things I think we've lost track of, there's a lot of people that talk about what is an appropriate differential between what the CEO of a company makes and what the lowest price worker makes. I want to be real careful here because I don't think anybody should dictate what that ratio should be. But at the end of the day, it makes total sense for the CEO not to make more than X amount more than the lowest price employee, because you're trying to pull everybody up in the company to make sure that everybody makes more. And for the CEO to hog it all is, in my opinion, not fair. Now, I think that we've allowed things to get a little out of whack. I think that the administration of healthcare makes a lot more than the providers of healthcare. And anytime you're in the situation where the administrators are making so much more money than the people that are actually getting the work done, that's a problem.
Agree.
And I think we're getting there, and I think we haven't yet looked at a lot of doctors, a lot of the practices, a lot of the things that doctors do have been put under the microscope. I don't think the administrators have been put under the same microscope, and I think it's time to get that done.
I would absolutely agree. I mean, they went for the lowest hanging fruit, which is the doctor. And as soon as you crushed or attempted to crush the private practice doctor and then forced them either to retire or to sell their practice to the hospital because they needed a salary, you know, just to survive, then you kind of had us from that standpoint. And I think this is a slow-moving iceberg. It didn't start with that. It started with reimbursements. And it started with us getting on insurance panels without knowing, without reading contracts, without knowing what the baseline was, that they could, you could see a patient. The insurance company would decide whether or not you get paid. And if they decided it was not medically necessary, then you couldn't even bill the patient. No doctor should have signed a contract that said that. And we did. And I did. And then I went back, I guess in about 2003, 4, 5, somewhere in there, and started reading them and started putting X's through, lines through, initialing, and just jumping off of insurance plans that refused to make changes. I mean, they can come back and take money from us forever. But we can only bill, if we don't bill within the first, I think, 6 months, maybe less now, 180 days, I think it's down to, you don't get paid. And that means you can submit it. And before it used to be paper, so you have to put it in the mail. They could say they never got it. They could throw half of them out. You resubmit it, but you've missed the deadline for resubmitting, and bam, you're out of luck. And then you couldn't seek restitution from the patient. That system was unequal to begin with. And then they started crying poor, which is just the funniest thing ever. The insurance companies are crying poor. Oh, we're taking so much risk. They're getting paid. They're getting subsidized from the government. They're getting paid from people who never use it. I think most people who have insurance, I'm going to say it's kind of a broad statement, but most people don't use their insurance very much. Maybe one health insurance if they're healthy. None, maybe once a year, that they paid $12,000, $20,000, that's all gone to the company, never to be seen again. There's no rollover. There's no credit. You just keep paying every year. This is like money going down a black hole. You can't even write it off anymore under the Obamacare system. So you've just given money, never to be seen again. And then now you have the insult that when you do go to see the doctor, and this is, I saw a patient a couple days ago who had allergy testing, who needed pulmonary function studies. And it got denied because pulmonary function studies were experimental. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's only been around for how many years? That's what they're doing. They're denying care after it's been given, saying that it's not medically necessary or experimental. It's a total scam. And nobody calls them on it. They just get to do whatever they want, but they're continually raising premiums, raising rates, making patients pay more deductibles. And I don't care anybody who tells me that, oh, everybody's covered, it's a win. They obviously don't read. They have no critical thinking skills, or they really don't care. They just want to win at all costs. How do we educate? What's the best? And this is another system question. How do you educate patients that you don't have to be a victim? You have choices, medical cost sharing, direct pay practices. That's the future, in my opinion, of healthcare for people with, with thinking people who really don't want to just be a cog in a wheel and support a system that's taking money from you and giving as little of it as possible back to you.
Wow. A lot there.
I know.
No disrespect intended toward doctors, okay? But you're right. Insurance companies did get doctors, okay? But in all honesty, doctors were kind of easy to get.
I agree.
Okay?
I agree. Weird fault.
Yeah. So they allowed themselves, okay? And they didn't necessarily see it was coming. They thought, well, this is going to be easy. I'll just sign the contract and I'll get paid and everything will be cool. Not really so much, right? Again, I come back to data. Okay, you've got to have, as a physician, especially as an independent physician, you have to have data to be able to protect yourself. If you can't argue or if you can't defend yourself with case studies and histories and good data collected on patients, mm-hmm. then you're going to be difficult. I also think I don't think it's a choice. I think it's a mandate. I think that individual practices have to begin to explain options to patients. I think it's good for the patient. I think it's good for the doctor's office. I think it's good for everybody. If the doctor can sit down when the patient comes into the practice, or if the practice has the patient ombudsman, okay, or a patient relations person who is responsible for helping the patient understand the choices that are available to them and how to make intelligent choices on what kind of coverage to get, and on how to work with the medical system in order to manage their health. Now, I mean, there are lots of people, patients and customers, who are in a break-fix mode. Mm-hmm. I just keep on going until I get broken. I don't go into the doctor's office. I'm not trying to manage my overall condition. That's one of the first things we have to teach people about.
I think that's a very good idea. It's about prevention and wellness. We talk a lot about it, but the system that's set up is not really about that. It's, okay, you get a mammogram or you get a colonoscopy, but they don't talk about what strategies you can do outside of those screening tests to help yourself. And they're actually poo-pooed. I mean, you're reading an article now about, vitamins aren't healthy. You shouldn't take them. But they don't tell you there's little subtleties here. Where the vitamins come from. I found it read recently, and I was shocked myself, that the vitamin E that they sell is petroleum-based. It's coming from, the oil industry. It's not natural. And no wonder it doesn't work. Or, you're dealing with fillers with all these vitamins where it's not necessarily the natural or the concentrated version. It's got so much stuff in it. Food coloring, gummy this, they're never going to work. And no wonder they do these studies and they come up with their answer because they're not actually, it's not apples and apples we're comparing. So it's set up to fail. And I love the ones that are set up by the pharmaceutical companies, those studies that tell you how bad vitamins are, but they're underwritten by, the company that makes the synthetic version that by prescription. I mean, we all have to be better consumers. I think it's about being critical thinkers and not being, just because someone says something doesn't make it true. I think that's the best take-home message there. Let's take another break. We're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're speaking with CEO of Medical Consultants Group, Mr. Frank Martin. And again, I'm going to say it again, we should just not take breaks because we have such great conversations in the break. And one of the things that we talked about, which I think really distills the show down, it's changing the paradigm. You gave me a story, and if you could repeat the story about the doctor who, the 80-20 rule, and so that we can take that and show people what we're talking about.
Everybody knows that 20% of your customers provide 80% of your revenue. I was speaking with a doctor the other day, and we agreed on that theoretically. And he said it would be easy for him to identify the 20% of his patients that provided 80% of his revenues. And so my question to him was, okay, that 20% of patients, are they part of the solution or are they part of the problem? And his first thought was, well, they're part of the solution. The solution to the problem, how do I make a living? Okay. If you shift the problem to how do I reduce the cost of healthcare, now all of a sudden these patients are not part of the solution, they're part of the problem. And your job is to help work with those patients and help them manage their health and manage their conditions so that they are no longer in that 20%. It's a legitimate question to say, well, that's all fine for you to say, but what happens to my revenue? Well, if you do a good job for those patients, you have to be able to utilize that to get good PR and get more patients in the door. Mm-hmm. Okay. Ultimately, you are better served because you have a broader base. Okay. Financially, you are better served to be getting less income from more patients.
Yeah. Volume in a good way.
Yes.
And, you know, if I took that, what you just said, one step further to change the paradigm shift from how do I teach my patients how to make smart choices, have real wellness strategies that keep them out of my office. And that's where the membership model, the direct pay model, I think really excels, because you're asking people to pay really what they pay for a cell phone, less than that, for the freedom and the mindset of if I get in trouble, I can see my doctor. I don't have to pay anything else. I'm going to be covered. I can see them when I need to see them, and I'm going to be well taken care of. That peace of mind is given. But there's also the time and the chance to teach them about how to make, you know, good decisions about what foods you need to eat, mindsets about choices of what medicines you really need to take, what you need to do to get off the medications that you're already on. That, to me, is what medicine is about. It's not just giving someone a 90-day refill. It's about giving them the tools so they can handle their own healthcare decisions so they don't end up in my office. I don't want to make money that way. But if the membership model continues to grow, we'll find that people are spending a fraction of what they've spent on an insurance model. They have the fail-safe of not having to end up in an ER somewhere. And they're better. They're healthier. They're enjoying their lives more. And the healthcare costs and the whole system goes down because they don't end up in someone's ER, OR, hospital, ICU. That all saves everybody money. And if there is really a finite amount of resources, if you don't have people making bad choices ending up in trouble, then the people who really need it actually have more resources to help them. That's really what healthcare should be, right? That's from ground up.
I'm involved in a study with a pediatric practice right now. We're testing whether or not some communication vehicles when sent to patients between the ages of 12 and 16 can get them into the practice to take their annual physicals. Once kids pass 11, they get done with the immunizations. It's hard to get them back into the practice. They're just a little too cool for that. Right? But it's a great time to establish habits that will be extremely beneficial to those patients for the rest of their lives. Because they're going to learn the value of an annual physical. And the physician will be able to do a better job of managing the patient's health. To a certain extent, it starts with the interaction between the doctor and the patient. Most of the time, when I have gone in to see a doctor, the question is, what's going on today? That's what you want to know? What's going on today? Mm. Okay, I'll tell you what's going on today because I understand why that's important. And I understand how that helps you manage my particular problem. But at some point in time, shouldn't you be saying, thank you, I appreciate what you told me, and now I understand what's going on today. Now I'd like to understand kind of what's going on with the rest of your life and existence.
It's okay? All connected.
Absolutely, it's all connected. But it's a significantly different change in tenor. It's a significantly different change in attitude. And it's a much more far-reaching and penetrating question to find out more about the patient. And I know I, for one, would very much appreciate being asked that question. I think there's a lot of other patients that would also.
I think that's an excellent point. I think if we would throughout society, basically, but slow down and really talk with instead of talk at each other. I mean, I think an average patient or average practice now is about getting to the next patient, getting through the volume that they have to get through the day. And getting home in a reasonable time. It's not about someone who's complicated. And if someone has a question and somebody has multiple problems, I've heard some of the practices can only deal with one problem at a time, and you have to come back for other successive problems. How does that work? But, you know, one, they don't reimburse doctors for multiple problems, right? So if you have two or three different problems and you try to separate them as a 59 modifier is what it's called, different procedures on the same day, they won't pay for it. So it's being driven by outside forces that's one of the reasons that we're ending up here in the system in the first place. Doctors need to take responsibility because we just said we'll work harder, not smarter, and we'll get more people to help us and we'll make it work when it was never going to. Now we're seeing what we reap what we sowed, basically. But now we have to, and patients too, who want to be, you know, remotely treated and like it. If I were a patient, I wouldn't want my doctor to call me in a prescription. I want them to see me. I want them to actually, again, patient came in the other day. He was seen by another ENT who never even examined him, walked in the door, maybe heard the history and then wrote a prescription and walked out, never touched the patient. And he came to see me because he didn't like it. First of all, if patients have the power here, don't go to see doctors who you feel abused in some way by emotionally. They didn't listen to you. They treated you poorly. Don't see those doctors. If they don't have a patient base, if it's all about the market share, they don't get it. They'll figure out at some point, I got to change something about my practice to make me more palatable to patients, right? Vote with your pocketbook. Same thing with insurance companies. Same thing with everything. It's just, you have more power than you, most of us. We don't exert the power that we have. And then we feel victimized and then we turn off and then it just, apathy kicks in. What we're talking about today is a way for everybody, doctors and patients, to take their power back. And I think you're right, it does come down to data. And if we can figure out, instead of seat of your pants, but in a concerted manner, this is what I want to get to. This is how I'm going to get there. That's what you're saying. Then it would be a much, much smoother ride, would it not?
Boy, I think so. And I think you're absolutely right about the financial model. If the patient puts themselves, or if the doctor and the patient work together to put the patient on a subscription model, it changes the nature of the entire conversation. Okay. Now, all of a sudden, it's a partnership. Mm-hmm. Okay. Designed for one goal. But I still think that's a great thing to explain up front. And when the patient presents to the practice for the first time, patient comes in and they've got just a splitting headache or they've got discharges from their ears. I mean, mm-hmm. You got to deal with that first. You have to. But as soon as you deal with the immediate problem, then you got to say, okay, now let's talk about what it means to be a patient of this practice and what my goals are. And if you buy that, great. I welcome you with open arms. If you think that's a bunch of hooey, okay. Right. But you've made your stance. Mm-hmm. You can't be all things to all people. No one can. But I think each individual practice has to make it pretty clear that this is what our goal is. And I do think there's enough people who are upset with the medical system that the doctors will find themselves well heard, well understood, and appreciated if they take that position.
I think you're right. I think it's, to me, the last few Supreme Court decisions and legislative decisions now have come full circle. And it's a good thing, in my opinion, because it forces doctors and patients to make some changes. We can't expect someone to help us and lead us down the right path. We're going down the wrong path and we're doubling down on it. And for those people who are unhappy about it, these are options. And it's all about options. I don't think there's one way to do it. Some people want to be taken care of from cradle to grave. That's awesome. They should have that. There's doctors who don't want to think, just let me see a patient and you handle the back end and the front end and I'm good. And I think there's room for everybody. I just want to make sure that people who want a choice know they have a choice in terms of physicians and patients.
I totally agree. And that starts with marketing. I think the doctor has to market himself the right way, and he or she has to understand how to get to the people in their designated market with that message.
Much agreed. So for our listeners, how can they reach you?
Phone number is 404-272-4883. You can always check out www.medicalconsultantsgroup.com. I should know this off the top of my head, but I don't know my Twitter handle or my Facebook page, but I've got both. So you can get me any one of those ways.
Well, I look forward to having you back on because I think this is a conversation that needs to be had over and over because it's an evolving situation and it's fluid. And that's the whole point, is to be nimble in order to navigate this system. So I want to thank you so much for coming the time to come on my show, and I look forward to it in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call. You can follow me on Twitter and on Facebook. And I have a new book coming out, which is on ebook now on Kobo, Big Medicine, The Cost of Corporate Control and How Doctors and Patients Working Together Can Build a Better System. Take care. I'll see you next week.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.